Hello, this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence. I'm here today with Marta Getty. She's been a master for 30 years?
29 years.
29 years, sorry. And I'm really happy to have Marta on the show. She's been interviewed a couple of other times before. And, you know, in this theme of traveling Reiki masters and hoping to give you listeners a little taste of what it's like for masters to go to different countries, there are the very romantic kind of things that happen, wonderful friends that you meet, and land that you discover that you have a personal connection with, and so on. But there's also challenges, and there's also a lot of travel fatigue, if we may call it that. And it's not just physical, but it's everything else. And one of the things about Marta is that she took the call of Reiki very seriously from the very beginning and has been on the road for many of those 29 years. And the other thing that I would like to kind of segue into or bridge into is a little talk about what has it been like to be a master and to dedicate your life to this practice, and what has that brought you? So we're going to try to fit a lot of things in this one small hour of conversation. So we better get going. So Marta, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for inviting me again.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure. And just very briefly, because I know that you've shared this with others, can you talk a little bit about how you met Reiki and sort of where you were in your life at the time?
Okay. When I heard about Reiki, it was I must have been 34 or 35 years old, and I had a teacher, Bethel Fay, who eventually became a master initiated by Mrs. Takata. And we were working together. She was my mentor and my teacher in learning to be a Gestalt therapist, and we worked a lot together. I did a lot of organization for her, for groups. And that started in the mid-70s, maybe 74, 75. I don't remember exactly now. And she was a very interesting person and an exciting person to be around, because she didn't seem to have many limits on what was possible in life. So at the end of the 70s, at one point, I totally trusted her.
Uh-huh.
She was an amazing, amazing person. And one day she called me on the telephone and she asked me to organize a class for her. And I said yes, but without any other, she didn't say anything about what it was about. She just said, would you organize a class for me? And I said, yes, I'd love to, of course. And then she said, but wait a minute, it's something different. It's Reiki. And I would say, from the reaction I had physically, which I could describe as all the signs inside, excitement, and everything was right, and having a vision, the first vision in my whole life, in that moment,
wow,
showing me the road ahead of me was going to be Reiki.
Wow.
And I asked at that point, what was Reiki? Because I had never heard the word before.
Right.
And she told me it was something to do with hands-on healing. So I suddenly went, oh, I don't want to do this, because I already studied that stuff and it doesn't really work with my life. But when I told her that, she said, Marta, this is something totally different and it's utterly simple. And please, in this moment, just trust me, because I don't know how to explain it to you any better than that, but trust me. And since I had always trusted her, I said yes. And that changed my life. Totally.
Uh-huh. Wow. Trust. Well, that's a good word. And often it's really interesting, because I feel that when we step into this path of mastery, it's one of the things that, unknown anyway to me, I realized that trust was one of the qualities that I needed to develop, in the sense of trusting others, but also to be trustworthy. And it sounds like Bethel had this trustworthiness quotient really high with you. at the time.
She did.
Yeah.
She very much did. Well, she had always shown me reasons to trust, and she'd never done anything that made me not trust her.
Uh-huh.
I mean, sometimes she scared me half to death with her driving.
Yes.
And I insisted on doing the driving.
Yeah, but she never had an accident.
Oh, she only ran over herself once.
Right, I know, but that's different. We won't go into that story.
I don't really want to anyway.
I was there when it happened, but we'll leave the listeners kind of on the edge of their seats with that one. And so you were initiated in first degree.
Yes.
And then
go ahead.
And then you had this feeling that this would be your life.
Well, actually, she initiated me into first and second degree all in the same week.
Uh-huh. Well,
and so I'd never had a chance to actually experience what first degree was like all by itself, which I regret now, but she and I both didn't know any better at the time, so my students know the difference because I uh-huh. asked them to wait before they do second degree.
And then what happened? So you took first and second degree in 1 week, and then...
Well, then people started, I don't know, it was the first night that after I had the two classes, people started coming to have treatments. And from that point on, for the next 2 months, there were 3 to 5 people every single day asking for treatments. And that was 7 days a week.
Wow.
And I had no idea what I was doing, but I just did what I had been taught in the classes, and it worked.
Uh-huh.
And that's another level of trust.
Right.
Because I had no idea what I was doing, and when people came and laid down on my table, I just did those things that I was taught to do, nothing more, nothing less. And it worked, and people would say to me, that was a wonderful experience, please, can I have another treatment tomorrow or next week or whatever? And they told their friends about it. And so I got to practice right away.
Mm-hmm. And this was in 1980?
Yeah, it started in May of 1980.
Uh-huh. And hardly anybody at that point had heard of Reiki. I mean, it was really an unknown quantity thing. Yeah?
I would say. Well, first of all, I would like to tie it back into what happens when people travel with Reiki, this
okay.
part.
Okay.
Because my teacher in Reiki was someone who drove 1,000 miles to do a Reiki class in my town.
Uh-huh.
And it was the first Reiki class that had ever been taught there.
Uh-huh.
And in a year and a half, there were so many people interested in that she kept coming back. And there were 400 people initiated in that year and a half.
Wow. Beautiful.
In first degree. And many of those went on to second degree.
Uh-huh.
You know. So she was a traveling master. And maybe somewhere inside of myself, because I knew that Mrs. Takata had traveled to where my teacher Bethel was, and had traveled to other places around the United States, at least the western part. Somehow I had the idea that masters did travel.
Uh-huh. Well, I think that was so at that time.
I think so, too. There weren't very many masters either, so I guess they must have traveled to
uh-huh.
get anybody initiated. So for me, that next period of time of practice and organizing, and I organized and organized and organized for Bethel. She was coming back, but at the beginning it was going to be 2 months. But it began to be more frequent, you know, 6 weeks and whatnot. And then she would do these large classes because people kept coming. So I had the experience of listening to her teach over and over
uh-huh.
and over again, and the privilege of experiencing her growth as a teacher, as a master, and watching her become more sophisticated, understanding what she was doing more. And for me, that was incredibly impressive and a wonderful example.
Uh-huh.
Wonderful example.
Uh-huh. Beautiful.
So, well, and there's one more little thing, too. It's a pretty big thing for me because it still is funding my life today. And that was about 6 months later, Bethel came back to teach classes, and she brought Mrs. Takata with her. And during that time, I had a lot of experience of listening to Mrs. Takata tell her stories. And for some strange reason, as naive as I was and unexperienced in respecting my elders, She was an incredible gift to me, and she answered every single question I asked her.
Wow.
Everyone. And I, you know, it was a week, so I had lots of questions. And I'm still hearing the answers today. When something new comes up, I went, oh my gosh, I asked that question. Here's what she told me.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens beautiful. Over and over again. Yes. So, again, my teacher traveled to me because I felt she was my teacher also. And I asked her if she would be willing to accept me as a Reiki Master candidate. And as I've said before, I had stayed up all night with thinking of reasons she should say yes, expecting her to say no. And when I said, I have a question to ask you, I would like to become a Reiki Master. She didn't say, no, oh, absolutely not. You're way too young. You're too this, you're too that, nothing. She just looked at me in the eye and she said, yes. I mean, how deflating. I was prepared for battle and it didn't work, you know. I had to do it in peace.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm. Well, she told me that eventually when I was ready, she would come and she would teach me and train me as a master, or I could come and travel with her and be taught and trained as a master in that way. But she died 2 months later, and I didn't get that chance. So she left, and there was this amazing woman who called me about 2 months later, and she said, my grandmother told me that I was to come and to initiate you as a master, but I have to meet you first. I don't want to initiate anybody I don't know. And do you know who that was?
Yes.
Yes, he recognized the story. It was you. So.
Yes.
Another traveling master.
Yes, it was true. That was an amazing experience, though. I mean, the first masters that I initiated, I feel, came... I was like an emissary of my grandmother, you know, when I did that. So, well, that's interesting. Yeah.
In some ways, I always had the feeling that we were growing up together.
Yes.
In Reiki.
Well, it was true. I mean, I was really a beginner, and so we were initiated around the same time, and you know, as a master. And I mean, I was just a baby master at that time, if you can call it that. So, when was the first time that you got called out to travel?
Was relatively shortly after my initiation. Within a few weeks, someone had called from another city and said, oh, we heard that you teach Reiki. That's not true, actually. The first class that was away from Eugene, which is where I lived, was when I traveled with you right after my initiation to Portland.
All right.
And we taught a class, I think, of 8 people up there.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first trip that I took in teaching Reiki.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few weeks after that, they called me from Portland again, and they asked me to come back and teach a class. And from then on, it was full on.
Mm-hmm. And was the first country that you traveled to Australia? That was outside the United States?
Yes. Yes, in fact. And that was amazing, too, because it all begins at home. It didn't happen that somebody from Australia called me.
Oh, yeah.
It was somebody who was, well, Barbara West and I had both been initiated by then as masters. Barbara lived in Eugene, and we were good friends. And we had a mutual friend who had taken first degree from me, and then she wanted to do second degree, but she knew both Barbara and I. And so she asked Barbara and I to work with her together for her second degree, which we did. And then afterwards, eventually, her husband, who was a professor at the University of Oregon, then got a sabbatical year where he was meant to go down to Melbourne, Australia. And she went down there, and then she wrote to both of us, to Barbara and myself, and she said, I really would like some company. I'm missing everybody from there so much. And she said, I wonder if one of you would like to come down and teach a class.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So Barbara and I talked, and Barbara didn't want to travel at that time for some reason I don't remember. And so I said I would like to go because at that point I was actually free to be able to go unexpectedly. So I traveled down to Australia, to Melbourne, and I stayed for 3 weeks. And I did teach a class, and then out of that class there was a request to teach a second class.
Uh-huh.
And so I taught that class. And then afterwards everything just grew from that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to acknowledge that this lovely woman, whose name was Sarah Lee Suttle, she was a lovely, lovely person who really wanted me there, and she made everything possible at that time.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Mm. And were you surprised at the differences of the Australian culture, or how was that for you? Or did you find that there were differences? Maybe I should ask that question.
Well, let me say, I had never really traveled out of the country other than to Mexico once and to Canada, and both without ever having to really interact with the people who live there very much, or especially in Mexico. And so when I went to Australia, I just went to Australia expecting to visit with my friend Sarah Lee. And instead, the first surprise happened for me. The woman who Sarah Lee had found to organize the first class picked me up at the airport to take me to Sarah Lee's home. And we got into the car, and the first thing that happened was that I walked around to the passenger side that we would use here
right. In
the States. And she started laughing, and she said, "Excuse me, but this is Australia. We drive on the other side of the road." It never even occurred to me. I had no idea that that would be so.
Uh-huh.
So I got in the car, and she started driving, and it was terrifying because I was on the wrong side of the car for that. I was trying to drive the whole time.
Uh-huh.
So that was the first cultural difference I noticed.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing was maybe something that actually happened the night before I left to come to Australia. Someone who had just been down there visiting called me on the telephone and said, "There's two things that you need to take." And I said, "What was that?" And there were two things, but I don't remember what the second thing was. The first thing was ketchup. And I said, "What? Ketchup? Why would I take ketchup in my suitcase? It's heavy." And she said, "Because they don't have it there." Well, actually, I never used very much ketchup anyway, but I just kind of laughed and said, "Well, I can't imagine that there wouldn't be ketchup there. I mean, they probably have McDonald's or something, and they've got ketchup for sure." And she said, "I went to the store, and I never found any." I said, okay, fine, but I'm not taking any ketchup. It's too heavy to carry. When I got to go to a store for the very first, on the very first chance after I arrived, Sarah Lee, for some strange reason, asked me to get some ketchup. So I said, okay, and I looked and looked and looked, and finally I just asked a sales clerk, "Where's the ketchup?" And she started laughing, and she said, "Oh, we don't have ketchup here." I said, "Oh, you don't have it?" She said, "We call it tomato sauce."
Ah.
Same thing, same brands, tomato sauce.
Oh.
And they're funny, funny, funny experiences sometimes with these things.
Uh-huh. Great. And what was the class like? Was it the same as teaching in the States?
Not exactly. I don't know how quite to describe it, except that generally the class itself, as I taught it, was I did as I always did. But how it was received was different.
Mm-hmm.
The people seemed to be more outspoken, for instance.
Uh-huh.
They spoke out. They asked their questions. They interrupted. They didn't listen immediately sometimes. They wanted to ask me questions about things, and they would tell me their experiences. And sometimes it drove me crazy because I wanted to teach, and they had all kinds of input they wanted to put in. And I had to learn how to manage that.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah. And in the years, you've gone back and forth to Australia quite a bit.
Yes.
Yeah. Great. Well, that's been a wonderful and ongoing relationship, which has become very deep. And I'm just wondering, what were the gifts that Australia gave you as far as the country and the people, the culture?
Well, I mean, there's so many, but I'll give you a few of them.
Okay.
One of the first things was that they helped me become more outspoken myself.
Uh-huh.
I had a tendency to be quite shy, and I also had a tendency sometimes to not speak up for myself.
Uh-huh.
And if there were others who were speaking loudly, I had a tendency to stay in the background.
Uh-huh.
And there, the people seemed, especially the women, because the men were pretty much the same as what I'd met before, but the women were so aware of who they were.
Mm-hmm.
Very strongly aware, and I had to begin to be more aware of myself in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And to accept myself differently.
Mm-hmm. To accept yourself differently, and what was that like?
Well, they weren't afraid of talking about themselves and saying, I'm this or I'm that.
Uh-huh.
And I had always been taught that one stays in the background, one does not speak up and say, I'm special, or I'm this, or I do that, or look at me. Instead, one just stayed in the background.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, in a way, it became a little bit more balanced for me.
Uh-huh. Great.
So, and I remember that as a young woman, I felt ashamed when people would look at me and point at me in some way and say, oh, she does this or she does that that's good in this way. I felt almost as if I had done something incorrectly or I'd done something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so in Australia, I began to learn that it's all right to be aware of who I am, but not to be full of myself.
Uh-huh. So there's a difference between the two.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Very big difference.
Uh-huh.
I had to learn that one, too. I started believing them when they would tell me, oh, you're magnificent, you're wonderful, you're special. And I thought, oh, maybe I'm magnificent, wonderful, and special.
Wow.
So then I had to learn that there's a balance in that.
Uh-huh, I see.
Good lessons.
Yeah, very good lessons. Anything else?
Well, I learned that in Australia, people tended to do whatever they wanted to do with Reiki.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't say, this is the practice, this is how I'm going to do it. They said, this is what I learned, and now I'm going to see how I can use it for myself.
Uh-huh.
And they were very creative sometimes.
Uh-huh. And was that okay for you?
Sometimes it was okay. Sometimes I was appalled. Sometimes I was inspired.
Uh-huh.
Because they came up with ideas about things that I had never thought of.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people did things that were hard to watch.
Mm-hmm.
I would say those are some of the interesting things I learned about. And I learned to be more tolerant because at first I thought things were just always done the way that I knew them to be.
Uh-huh.
So when I went to Australia, I had to learn that people had different points of view and different ideas about some of the same things that I did, but they didn't do it the same way as me.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to learn to accept that that was okay.
Uh-huh. Great. Wow. Some great lessons.
Important ones.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then at some point you moved, you also have spent a lot of time in Europe, in Italy, as a matter of fact,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
And in the UK. So how did you get to Italy? That's an interesting story.
I'm not sure I even remember how that all happened.
But
I'll try to remember.
Well,
yeah.
Okay.
I think I do. I remember now. I was in Australia, and I had the opportunity to have a round-the-world tour for the same price as a ticket one way each direction.
Uh-huh.
And so I accepted that ticket. From Australia, I had the opportunity to go to India, to Egypt, and then to England. And I was curious about England because, of course, a lot of my own roots are in the United Kingdom, Irish mm-hmm. and Scots and English and Welsh. And I wanted to find out what that was really like.
Oh, yeah.
So
uh-huh.
I did that. I went. I stayed a few months, and I had the opportunity to teach some classes there, which was really very nice. And then in 1986, there was a woman that was in another group that had nothing to do with Reiki. And I had gone to that group as a guest to do Reiki for the instructors. And they had offered me the course as a gift in exchange for doing Reiki.
Uh-huh.
And there I met this young woman who did massage. And I said, oh, it would be wonderful to have a massage. Maybe I can trade a Reiki treatment with you for a massage. And she said, okay, when the group is over, we'll do that in the next few days. So I went to have my massage first from her. And she said, how was my massage afterwards? And I said, it was lovely. It was really a nice massage. And she said, is there anything I could do differently or better? And then I said, well, the only thing I could even suggest to you is that it's really nice to have massage from someone who has Reiki because there's such heat in their hands.
Uh-huh.
And she said to me, what's Reiki?
Uh-huh.
And so, of course, I explained it. And then she wanted to be in a class.
Right.
And she told me afterwards, she didn't quite understand it, but she started noticing a big difference in her hands. And then she gave a treatment to one of her friends. And it seemed this young woman that I first gave Reiki to there was called Sylvia, and she was from Italy. And so then she told this to another friend of hers who wanted to then come to do a class with me, which was in another city in England. And she did, and her name was Antonella. And Antonella, after the class, said, would you be willing to go to Italy to teach? I said, oh, no, I don't speak Italian. And I would have to have a translator, and that's a lot of work. That's really hard, and yeah, I'm sure there must be teachers in Italy. And she said, well, I'll see if there are. So she went back to Italy, and she practiced for a while, did a lot of treatments. And then she called me, and she said, I would like to come and do my second degree, and this must have been maybe 18 months or 2 years later. And she came over, and I happened to be spending the 3 months in Wales at that point in time, so she came to stay where I was staying, and I did her second degree. And then she said, would you please come to Italy to teach? And I said, oh, no, I don't speak Italian, and et cetera. And she said, okay. And then she went back to Italy, and she did so many treatments that she called me 2 weeks later, and she said, listen, I would like you to come to Rome to do a class. I have 24 people who've made up deposits, and they would like you to teach here. You tell us the date.
Wow.
I said, okay, well, that'll cover my expenses, so okay, I'll come. And who will translate for me? And she said, I will. And I said, okay. So I went. And it was a very, very amazing experience, a wonderful experience, beautiful people that I could not understand a word of what they were saying to me. Everything had to go through the medium of a translator.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first time that I had really experienced such a huge contact with people through someone else.
Mm-hmm.
So from that point, then people just kept calling and wanting classes. So I ended up coming back until one day I realized I was mostly there.
Uh-huh.
Instead of anywhere else. And I still traveled to Australia, and I still traveled to England, and I still traveled to other places, to the United States and whatnot. But at that point, I guess somewhere I had made a commitment to be in Italy a lot. And you know, the funny thing was I never really particularly wanted to go to Italy.
Hmm.
So, I mean, it wasn't big on my list of where I wanted to go in the world. Australia had been. It was the first and biggest place I'd ever wanted to travel to, and I got to actually do that. But Italy had not been on my list, even though I'd studied art at university and whatnot. So
mm-hmm.
It just somehow didn't appeal to me in the way that Australia had. But it turned out it was a very important place for my growth in many ways.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And I mean, just in my own imagination, I can imagine that the culture of Italy is quite different than Australia.
Oh,
okay, maybe
yes.
That says it all.
Yes, it might say it all. And also very different from the United States and nearly every place else in the world. It was remarkable and scary and wonderful and inspiring, and I never had been any place that was so chaotic in my life.
Uh-huh.
Nothing was organized. Nothing. I could go into a bank, and if I needed to have somebody help me, three or four people would just push in front of me, and that I had to learn to be more assertive and say, wait, wait a minute, I was here first. Which you can't do very easily if you don't speak the language.
Uh-huh, right. So what did you use, your elbows, or?
No, not that. I learned how to say, wait a minute, it's my turn. You can wait your turn.
Really?
I learned to say that more
really
in Italian.
Really complicated.
It was at the beginning. So it, once in Trieste, I stayed in Trieste for a few years. Well, I used it as my base for a few years because I traveled a lot outside the country. I would go back every time, and I would go immediately to the grocery store to stock up on whatever was needed in the apartment for groceries. And every time I would go into the store, there would be these really sweet-looking older ladies. I would guess, you know, let's say they were at least 70, even though I'm getting closer to that myself now. I would say that they seemed older to me at the time.
Right.
And they were tiny and short and generally kind of round. And they would get behind these big shopping carts, and they would fill them up with groceries. I mean, heaving. Sometimes you couldn't even see the person over the top of the groceries.
Wow.
And they would come up behind me, and they'd bang into me. And I had scars for a long time on the backs of my ankles where they bumped me with the carts, and it actually had cut me. And I didn't say anything. I kept thinking of honor your parents, teachers, and elders, and these are old ladies. So, you know, honor them. They didn't really mean to run into your legs. They just did that by accident because they couldn't see over the pile of groceries. And then one day, I was very tired when I got back, and I went to the store, and I was, I got a few things to take back to my apartment. And along, as I go up to the, as I go up to the cashier, there was a lady in one of these carts that came right up behind me, and she didn't hit me. She said to me, "Can I go first?" And she's heaped with groceries, and I've got about 15 items in my cart. And I said, "No, I'm first." I'd learned that at the bank. So I turned around to push my, cart through the cashier because it was my turn next, and she ran right into the back of my legs. And I guess that was it. I was too tired that day, and I just exploded. And I just said, "Don't you ever do that to me again." In English, of course, I'd lost it. I couldn't speak any Italian at that point. And I just said, "Don't you ever do that to me again." And I just was so upset. And then I felt terrible that I'd yelled at this old lady. But from that moment on, whenever I shopped in that store, not one single person ever ran into me again.
Interesting.
Well, it was quite a lesson. Well, probably not the story you thought you were going to hear.
No.
But it was a very interesting lesson. Mm-hmm. And luckily the scars have gone away now.
Good.
After all these years.
Right. And how were the classes? I mean, what was it like to teach through a translator, but also to teach Italians?
Well, translation of Italian is rather interesting because many times, depending on the translator, it takes twice as long to say whatever was said in English.
Uh-huh.
So that means that you have to either extend the classes, class time, which is what I did at first because I didn't know any better. And then, after time passed, I began to get simpler and simpler and simpler with my teachings. And, you know, although that's kind of a cultural thing, it was a really wonderful lesson for me. Because there's a tendency to talk too much. I mean, I can do that.
I think all of us can.
Yeah,
that's a beautiful one.
Yeah, well, now, of course, you know, in the last few years, I've been teaching in Italian, and I've stayed simple with my Italian. And it takes less time than it ever took before, even when I was teaching in the States or Australia. And I find that people understand what I have to say about Reiki much more. It's simpler, it's clearer, and more profound for them.
That's great. Wonderful.
Yeah.
So, you're still traveling.
Yes.
And how is that for you? Do you find it exhausting? Do you need to take time out for yourself? I mean, how do you keep yourself healthy, like not just physically healthy, but sort of mentally and emotionally healthy?
Good question. Well, that's another thing that has to be learned. Sometimes, I guess there may be people who are instinctive with it, but I wasn't. I had such a joy in teaching Reiki, and I loved the experience so much. And I loved the people who came to the classes for the most part. They were just so inspiring and so beautiful, and they taught me so much in working with them that I didn't have any stops. I just taught as much as I could.
Uh-huh.
I did whatever I could do. But I discovered that after time, it was really necessary if one was initiating a fair number of people to stop and integrate.
Mm.
That's, and not only that, but stop and integrate was really important. So the reason for that, and this is my belief, it's not necessarily the truth, I believe that as a master, what pushes me to grow is the initiations and the teaching of the students that I work with.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't honor that by stopping for a while, absorbing and integrating, I am not giving back what I really need to give back.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that we live, you know, humanity lives in a stressful way. We're running and pushing and hurrying every single day. You know, we work on our computers. We do everything faster and more instantly than what we did before.
Mm-hmm.
And there's less time to absorb the things that happen. And so because of that, I learned or began to learn that I needed to take time to let it all in for myself. And I began to speak that a little more in my classes, that people needed to take the time out. And that was one of the things that served out, was that I would say the same thing that I do every single day of my life, with rare exception, which is to treat myself every single day.
Mm-hmm.
That helped me to absorb. But then there was another level that was important too, and that was to take time out to have fun.
Mm-hmm.
Go to the movies, hang out with friends, go swimming, read a book, just, you know, meditate, or to have a good meal somewhere and not always focus directly on Reiki.
Mm-hmm.
Because mm-hmm. always being focused is pretty narrow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I needed a wider life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I began to find ways of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And people helped me do that, too. You know, people invited me to do things, and I began to invite people to do more things than what I'd probably ever done before. And that was really useful in helping me to see how the everyday life that we lead doesn't necessarily have to be focused on Reiki. It's just that Reiki flows through everything that I do, everything that we do. And so, therefore, it's okay to take time off to relax, because even in relaxing and integrating, the Reiki was present, even if I wasn't talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So that was an important part of it. And then the other thing is that over the years, I found it really important. I think that about 10 years into teaching Reiki, I began to take time off periodically, you know, several months at a time, and give myself a retreat, so to speak. So I would perhaps go to Australia for 6 months and rent a van and drive around Australia, or go to the desert, or, you know, experience life in a little bit different way and take time out for me. And that was really important, and I did that several times.
Mm-hmm.
Not every 10 years, but, you know, several times. And that was huge in allowing me space to grow inside. Every
mm-hmm.
time I came back afterwards, I had grown.
Mm-hmm.
And
beautiful.
I understood Reiki better.
Mm-hmm.
Not to speak of me.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you first started to teach Reiki, what did you feel you were imparting in the first degree class?
What do you mean?
Well, how did you see it? Did you see it as a way for people to heal them, heal broken bones and so on, or did you, I don't know, was it some mysterious thing that you were doing? I don't know, I'm just trying to, I don't know how to ask the question without leading you. So,
okay.
I just feel like for myself, so, when I first started teaching Reiki, it was very innocent, and somehow I just, and not by rote, but I did it in a way that really paid attention to, you know, what if my teacher were sitting in the room, if my master was sitting in the room, that I would pay attention to what I said and what I did and so on. And then, you know, I think I went through phases in my teaching where I felt like I was really giving people an opportunity to grow inside and to have personal development. And then now I feel like I just introduce it as my own spiritual path, and I trust that the students there will find their path within Reiki, whatever that is. So that's been my journey in teaching, actually.
Well, I would say there are some parallels in that for me. I probably came at it a little differently than you, because you had a lot of indoctrination from your grandmother. And when I had learned first and second degree, my teacher had arrived saying, I don't know why it's going to take so long. There's nothing to teach. And she had demonstrated a body in the air and put hands, she showed us the positions in the air on an invisible body and said, that's the first degree treatment. It was all done in 5 minutes or so. And because of that, and the very short teachings, you know, the basic and important things were all taught in both classes, but there wasn't much taught. It seemed like the time was very short, and there wasn't much to learn. Because I learned in that way, I was afraid that I wouldn't be giving the right things to the people who came to the classes. So what I did, I was thinking they came because they wanted to learn about healing. I didn't think spiritual pathway. I didn't think about personal growth.
Right.
I didn't think about, let's do a daily Reiki treatment. I just thought, I want these people to get their money's worth, and I would like people to know about how to do healing. And so rather than taking in less than 2 hours for each section of the class that Bethel had taught, which was mostly taken up by doing the initiations, I started teaching these long classes that started sometimes at 9 in the morning and didn't end up till 8:30 at night, of course, with breaks, because I wanted to make sure everybody got all the information. And it was exhausting.
I can imagine.
Exhausting. And, of course, I told stories endlessly. So, you know, I wanted everybody to have an idea what Reiki was or what they could do with Reiki, not realizing myself there was a whole lot more to Reiki than that.
Right.
So, and then I began to see how it, you know, this is after a couple, 2-3 years or so, I began to recognize that I was actually getting a whole other level of Reiki that I hadn't known even existed, which had to do with my personal growth. So when things were upsetting or things happened or I didn't understand what was going on or anything, I would then Reiki the situation, or I'd Reiki myself, and then I'd Reiki the situation to find out the answers, and often that would help. And sometimes it would lead me to going to see a therapist or to do something different than what I had expected to do. And I began to see myself rounding out somewhat. No, I've always had an issue with controlling everything around me, probably because of being afraid of not knowing what was going to happen. So I began to soften on that, and that helped. And then the next step after that was that somewhere around 7 or 8 years later, after I'd been taught first and second degree, I finally one day laid down on my bed and actually gave myself a full Reiki treatment for the first time. Always before that, I had treated a spot here or a spot there. If I had a need or if I did something to myself or I didn't feel well, I treated myself. And in just the place. This day, I gave myself a full treatment. And I did that because someone had said to me, your hands are so wonderful. It is such a privilege to have a treatment from you. I had no idea what they were talking about. I mean, except intellectually, because I had never received a treatment from myself. So I laid down and gave myself one. And it was a wonderful experience. And one I think that every person who treats themselves every day or treats themselves once in a while would identify with. So from that point on, I began to treat myself every single day, except under unusual circumstances. And I have done so for more than 20 years now.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And so how did you get to the point where you shortened the class? Because I assume that you have.
Well, I got there because I got so tired. I just couldn't, I couldn't teach those long classes and carry this. I felt like it was necessary for me to carry the role of being a master.
Carry the role of being a master. That's an interesting phrase.
Right. It's because I didn't understand that being a master was not mastery.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So mastery
was about that.
Okay. Mastery was about my life and using what I learned and learning also how to be with other people. But before that, I had this experience of being, well, let's say, a caretaker. And that meant that I needed to take responsibility because obviously other people couldn't take responsibility for themselves. And it was kind of arrogant on my part. And I had to learn to let it go. And the more I let it go, the more I realized I had less to say, less to do. And it spilled over into my classes. And part of that was, you know, being in Italy, where I had to speak always in another language. So it had to stay simpler and simpler because otherwise it was just too tiring. So people would say to me, but you have Reiki, why are you tired? And I would say, because I did a good day's work. You know, work makes you tired. If you've done work, you get tired from that. It isn't like being exhausted. But you do get tired, and you need to take some time to rest for that. And I started thinking, now how can I make this simpler? How can I do less but give what's necessary? And I was able to shorten my classes down. So one of the things that came out of that was that instead of talking day and night, you already know I can talk a lot because you can hear it now, I started saying, okay, let's do Reiki in the classes. So we did more and more Reiki. And every class that I teach now, people practice the full treatment, and they get parts of the treatment up to when they do their full treatment. And as a result, they have their own experience, and they have less questions. And the questions they ask are much deeper. So my students have been my teachers.
Great. Wonderful. Well, that's a wonderful, thank you very much for sharing that. It just puts me into a whole nother realm of my own recollections and, you know, what I feel like is a journey that I had, but it was different but similar. Just wanting people to get value and so on, and not realizing that the value that students would receive would come from their own practice rather than from what I had to say. And that was an interesting realization at some point in my teaching.
Do you find that it was about making Reiki more important than making our words more important? Knowledge more important?
I guess so, on a philosophical level. You know, when I would sit in on classes with Hawaii Otakata, she talked a lot, like incessantly, and her stories were always a big puzzle, a big question mark for me, because they didn't seem to have anything to do with Reiki. So a lot of your stories today have been a little bit reminiscent of that, like, you know, shopping carts and so on. And my understanding of the shopping cart story and so on is much more influenced by how I was introduced to Reiki, because Over the years, what I've learned is all these stories that she told that I felt like had nothing to do with Reiki somehow did.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
I can't really tell you what I learned or how I learned it, but I know that I did.
So you must have the same experience as me, though.
Oh, gosh. I mean, it's just so bizarre. And so sometimes in the class, I find myself telling a story, and I think, well, why am I saying this? This is so weird. This has nothing to do with Reiki. And then somebody in the class will say, oh, thank you for telling me that story. I just got something, or it helped me with this problem that I've been having. And it's just so weird and interesting.
Yes.
Huh?
Yes.
Yeah. So
that's exactly it.
Yeah. So sometimes words are great, but then there is this balance. And I think the balance that we've put into the classes from Hawaii Otakata's day, where the theory was a little bit like martial arts. You learn the technique part, then you go and practice on your own. And mm-hmm. the more you practice, the more value you have, because then you understand that it's not just a technique, it's something else. So that practice part was added to our classes by all the masters that Hawaii Otakata initiated, as far as I know. And I feel like that has been a really interesting change, because it helped teach us what the value of Reiki was.
Yes. But don't you realize that, I mean, I don't know if you've thought about this or not, but every single teacher that Mrs. Takata initiated was actually very young in the practice when she died. Maybe one person had 5 or 6 years, I don't remember.
Right.
But mostly everybody had 1 to 3 years maximum of being a master. And we were all probably in the same place. There was this place of teaching the technique and doing the positions correctly as they were taught. Everybody had a commitment to doing exactly the same positions their teacher had said, not realizing that sometimes she taught different positions because there were different needs. And I wanted to make sure that I taught what my teacher had taught me, so I didn't lose Reiki or I didn't mislead people.
Right.
Not realizing that Reiki wasn't the hand position.
Right.
So I think that's part of the growing up. That's where the spiritual aspects of Reiki begin to enter into this experience. And when I woke up one day, I don't know that I woke up exactly, but woke up in awareness, and realized that I had been following a spiritual pathway that Reiki had led me to, which was my own personal one, not mm-hmm. everybody's, I had been growing and growing in a way in my spiritual connection with everything that exists, and I hadn't even realized it was happening.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And part of it was this growth that we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I find this movement, the development of Reiki within a person and within actually a community, very fascinating. And I'd often like to do a sociological study on it, because I feel that there's something really inherent about the development of a human being that goes from, like, our physical needs, then our emotional needs, then our, our spiritual needs, and then there must be other needs, like community needs that we have, and that Reiki just brings us into this process so consciously, in a conscious way, that it allows us to look back and see the steps that we've taken.
Yes.
Without knowing it. I find that fascinating.
Well, There's some understandings, or at least for this moment, an understanding I think that I'm beginning to have about community that's kind of interesting for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that if we look back in time and we look at the small villages that people used to live in before everybody started moving to the cities, we look back, every village had their wealthy and their poor. Uh-huh. They had their alcoholics and their the whole gamut of every possible thing in human existence.
Right.
And there was a place in every community for all of that. Uh-huh. Maybe people didn't like everybody, or maybe people liked others more than these people. But there was always a place. The community included everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And what I saw as people moved into the cities is there was less and less and less caring for one another
mm-hmm.
that used to happen in the smaller villages mm-hmm. with all their prejudices mm-hmm. and everything. And so now what I see is that perhaps my conclusion isn't correct because I haven't finished learning about this, but what I see is we have an innate need for a kind of community where we do connect with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we find that in many different ways, mm-hmm. not just with Reiki, but Reiki's mm-hmm. my pathway, so of course I always talk about Reiki.
Right.
But in many, many groups, we look for groups, and we look for groups to help us feel like we're part of something. We look for family sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think we look for community to be included, and in that community is every type of personality, every mm-hmm. type of a human being.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's just a forum, an opportunity, a growing space, an incubation space to become who we each are
mm-hmm.
individually.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and we have a Reiki community,
mm-hmm.
and we spend time trying to define what that means. You know, like there's all these people around the world. Is everybody who has Reiki the same community, or is that about different schools of Reiki? Each one's a community, or what? We talk about those things. But the reality for me is that there's something in every single one of these schools or communities that does exactly the same
mm-hmm.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm beginning to appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that everyone on the planet seems to be mm-hmm. yearning for mm-hmm. something greater like that. At least it seems that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a beautiful thought to end our hour together. And I have one more. I have a tendency to get the last word in. And that is that, you know, if we see the world as holographic, that, you know, sometimes I look at the ripples in the sand on the beach near where the water comes and washes up and then the waves come and then smooth the sand. You can look and you can see all these ridges and stuff that you can look up and see the ridges and the cliffs in front of you, and you can, you know, see the ridges of the moon and so on. So there's this kind of natural holographic tendency for our world, our own environment. And I feel that this whole trying to define community is a bit like that. It's like, you know, you can see community in your own household, and you can see community in your own village or city, and then you can see community as a cultural community, and then, you know, our worldwide community, and the same for our forms of Reiki practice. So I feel that this is a really important lesson for us that Reiki is giving us also, is to be able to see the community within ourselves individually, all the different people that reside inside of our one body, and up to, you know, this international, maybe intergalactic community, and to be able to, you know, go back and forth, to be very inner, and to be, you know, all-inclusive. And this kind of movement, I feel like, really gives a human being just incredible depth perception.
I agree with you. I agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any more words to say about
mm-hmm.
that.
No.
You've been very succinct.
Mm. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Thank you, Marta, for being with us and for sharing all that you have.
Thank you. It's
yeah.
such a privilege to be here.
Yeah, and for me too. And for your listeners, we'll be back next week. Thank you very much for being with us. This is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki Balancing Form and Essence.